At 11, The Digital Divide talks to author, musician, and Portland punk icon John Shirley about technology, the environment, and politics. Plus, you can hear unreleased tracks from his forthcoming album. And we thank you, of course, KABU members, for your generous support. If you are not yet a KABU member, please take care of that right away by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button there in the upper right corner. We are out of time. We'll be back next week with Matt DeSantos from the ACLU.
Tune in then.
KABU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kabu.org.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball. They're playing basketball. We love that
basketball. Nope. No March Madness here for us, but we do have our very own special bracket that we want you, the listeners of KABU, to be part of. We'll be celebrating the melancholy March sadness this month, and we'd like you to contribute some music.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So just go to the KABU website and search Diablo Sadness, enter some songs, and then come back later to vote. We'll be broadcasting the winners on March 24th.
Sounds like she's having a good time.
She's crying. It's backwards. Sort of makes me sad when I hear it. Sounds like she's laughing, doesn't it?
KABOO!
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 a.m. And I am privileged as well as contractually obligated to let you know that this program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Nonesuch Records, now featuring the Magnetic Fields 50-song memoir, an album that chronicles the 50 years of songwriter Stephen Merritt's life with one song per year. The Magnetic Fields 50-song memoir, available now.
For the Pacifica Radio Network and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is The Beloved Community, resources for activism. I'm John Schock. My website is progressivespirit.net. That's progressivespirit.net. Catch The Beloved Community every second Friday at 9 a.m. on KBOO. Today, my three guests represent alternative ways of forming communities of conscience. Deshna Ubeda is the director of ProgressiveChristianity.org. She's taking on an ambitious project and hosting a festival in Portland May 4th through 6th. It's called the Embrace Festival.
You know, some people are coming because they're recovering from Christianity that they left because it was no longer relevant or it actually hurt them because they were excluded or demonized or villainized. Some people are coming because they are interested in theology from a historical perspective. Some people are coming because they are very interested in social justice movements or eco-ministry or interfaith relations.
Greta Vosper is an atheist and a minister in the United Church of Canada. For a while, at least. She was forced through a process of review because of her theological views. She talks about being an atheist and a minister and her community in Toronto, Ontario.
Sam Harris, in his book, The End of Faith, he does this thought experiment where we wake up one morning and And we don't remember anything. We don't remember language. We don't remember what foods we can eat. We don't remember anything at all. And he says, you know, at what point do we have to remember the story of the Virgin Birth, right? Like, that would be way down the list. And so that's kind of what happened at West Hill. We decided, what are the things that, if we were starting this all over again, are the most important things to take forward?
Brett Webb Mitchell is interim minister at St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church in Southwest Portland. He is a scholar, teacher, and author of 10 books. He's also a pilgrim. That's the discussion today. His latest book is Practicing Pilgrimage, on being and becoming God's pilgrim people.
For those of us who are gay or lesbian, bisexual, trans, queer, questioning, or intersex in the LGBTQI community, there is the useful metaphor of a closet. But there's, for me, the next step was not only the closet, got that, I felt that, but I needed a metaphor, I needed a way to talk about coming out. And for me, that was a pilgrimage.
Great show today. Let's get to it. My first guest in the KBOO studio is Deshna Ubeda. Welcome, Deshna, to the Beloved Community.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
What we're going to talk about today is the Embrace Festival, Sacred Community, Social Transformation, and Art. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yes. I'm really excited to be able to share this event with you. I believe that it's innovative and unique, and there isn't much else out there like this. Something similar might be the Wild Goose Festival, which is an outdoor camping festival.
Right, and it takes place in Appalachia.
Yes,
North Carolina.
But this is an in-city festival, and with a focus on sacred community and social transformation. And we really wanted to provide people with an opportunity to experience sacred community in a new way. As you know, probably, churches provided a certain amount of community and support networks for humans, you know, for thousands of years now. Mm-hmm. And as we've seen a decline in church attendance, many people, you know, are confident to say that church is dying. We're also experiencing a vacuum of community in our neighborhoods, in our, you know, local towns. And I think that people are craving a place to go where they can be seen, where they can be accepted, where they can get involved in meaningful work around social justice, around social activism, around helping the needy, and where they have a sense of family and something deeper than just their own selves. So while church is still relevant to very many people, I don't believe it's relevant to the younger generations anymore. And, you know, I certainly have a hard time finding a church that I want to attend. Not to say that there aren't a lot of really great churches out there, but they're rare. They're hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
And especially millennials just aren't going to go into a church, frankly. Maybe 7% of them would. And so while church is still relevant to, you know, certain demographics and certain people, it isn't to younger people. And a lot of people that I've talked to in my work feel very sad about that. They're very concerned that church is dying and there's going to be this spiritual vacuum for future generations. But what I've seen in my experience, and I'm kind of in the middle of those, I'm not a millennial, but I'm not in the older generation of you know, hardcore churchgoers, although I was raised in a progressive church. So I'm sort of in the middle of that. And what I've experienced is that younger generations are already and successfully co-creating new forms of sacred community. And you see a lot of that in these transformational festivals like Burning Man, like Beloved, like Envision, Lucidity. And those are just examples of some symbiosis. So these are pockets, you know, these are events that occur. And what happens is a culture is created there. These transformational festivals, people bring their gifts. People bring their unique offerings. And they end up co-creating this event, especially an event like Burning Man, where it's completely put on by the people. And people offer something special that they have. And There are temples. There is a connection to the divine, to the spirit in all people. There is inclusion. There is acceptance. People are encouraged to be their unique selves and are accepted as they are. And that culture, and that includes sacred economy culture, that includes a sustainability, so, you know, leave no trace, and some eco spirituality elements, and that includes bettering of ourselves and connecting with others and forms of prayer and worship and meditation, etc. That culture that's created ends up bringing, you know, being brought back into local communities, into lives, and extending into our daily lives and affecting culture. You might hear here in Portland a lot, you know, they're a burner. And that's relating to a person that goes to Burning Man. And you can usually tell, and, you know, there's, you have a certain amount of awareness around what that means if you're involved in those communities. So, you know, Burning Man brings 70,000 people a year out into the desert, you know, to create this incredible city of art and music and learning and connecting. And those people go out into the world and affect their culture there. So Embrace Festival, I wanted to be able to share that experience with a different demographic, not just the younger people that are already involved in those festivals and those communities, but also, you know, middle generations and older generations. One thing that I have noticed that's lacking in a lot of transformational festivals are the older generations, and in community in general. I have a great thriving community here, and it lacks some elders. And so I'm really hoping that we are bridging the gap age-wise, as well as between older forms of community and newer forms of community.
So there really is a generation gap, in a sense, as you've talked about, between the established institutionalized churches and these new festivals that are coming up all around.
There's definitely, you know, older and elder people at these festivals, but it's definitely like a slighter number. And I'm seeing that grow over the years. I've seen, for example, I've gone to Beloved for the last 5 years, and I've seen more and more elders come, and it feels so good to see them there, because we need all of the above. While these younger generations have innovative ideas and they're very, you know, creative and just, you know, it's incredible, like the creative, powerful thinking that are coming out of these new generations that aren't constricted in some ways. We are, you know, desperately needing the wisdom and experience of elder generations. And then obviously the other element of that is the social transformation part of it. And I don't need to go on about how great in need we are, you know, in our world today, for positive social transformation, for social justice movements, and not just talking about it, but actually learning from people that are affecting positive change, that will give us practical tools and guidance on how to go back into our local communities and affect change there, how to become leaders of social justice movements, how to create groups and other forms of affecting change. So those are kind of the two elements. And, you know, in sacred community, in social and personal and universal transformation, they're all kind of, you know, together there. I believe that art, music, dance, creativity are all really crucial aspects of that.
I'm speaking with Deshna Ubeda, who is organizing the Embrace Festival, which is coming up in Portland. And the dates of that are May 4th, 5th, and 6th?
Yes, exactly.
And this is the first of its kind in Portland?
Yes, it is.
Now tell me, you mentioned the Beloved Festival. What is that, and where has that been meeting? And how is this connected? How is this similar and different?
Yes, good question. So Beloved Festival is an incredible transformational festival that occurs out in Tidewater Falls in Oregon. And it's a once-a-year festival that happens during the summer. It is, you know, Beloved. It's based on the idea of the Rumi concept of the beloved, of the divine in all people. So one of their kind of main themes is to recognize everyone you come into contact with there as a part of the beloved, as a part of the divine. Mm-hmm. So it has that spiritual element of it, and they bring world music. And while and it's camping in the woods, and while these kinds of festivals have more of a focus on music and dance and the sort of performance aspect of you know, festivals, we have a stronger weight on the learning aspects of it. So we'll be focusing a little bit more on presenters and our speaking engagements and such, and a little bit less on the musical aspect of it, but we'll still have both.
But also some great musical groups. I look on the website, mm-hmm. which is embracefestival.org.
.com.
I'm sorry, embracefestival.com. Mm-hmm. And on there, some incredible presenters as well as musicians and artists. I saw Matthew Fox as, mm-hmm. as one of the headliners, I suppose.
Yep,
This certainly is up his alley.
It is, yes. Matthew Fox is an incredible theologian and pastor and author. He's written 28 books. Over the years, he has been at the front of this movement of progressing Christian theology.
Big on creation spirituality, his book that got him in wonderful trouble with the Vatican, Original Blessing.
Yes.
So he's been doing this for a long time. But this is more than Christian. This is a wide variety of spirituality. It probably has a home in Christianity, but it has a home in many spiritual traditions, including secular traditions, right? Greta Vosper is one of the guests, too. She's a friend from Canada who has become out as the atheist minister.
Yes, exactly. I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's a really important aspect of the event for people to understand, that while there are some roots in progressive Christian theology and that movement, it's very expansive. The umbrella is wide. And we have a speaker, for example, who is a Reiki master and a shaman who's coming to speak about shamanism. And we have evolutionary spiritual speakers. We have secular speakers. We have a man coming to speak on health equity, somebody speaking on conscious aging, an incredible psychologist friend of mine, Carrie Conti, who is speaking on basically raising whole courageous human beings, so parenting, permaculture, nonviolent communication, sacred connecting, like Solsara, that's a local movement here. So we're having someone come to speak about that. So yes, there is a wide variety of topics that fall under that umbrella of sacred community and social transformation. But we also wanted to address Christ consciousness and Buddha nature. And what does that mean to discover that within ourselves? And how does that affect our lives? How does that affect our action in this world?
You're listening to The Beloved Community, Resources for Activism on KBOO. Again, I'm speaking with Deshna Ubeda and the Embrace Festival coming up May 4th through 6th in Portland. Tell me a little bit, what is kind of Portland about this?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Yeah. So I thought that Portland, well, of course, I'm a local here, so it made it easy. But I thought that Portland would be the ideal location for this event because of its progressive nature. Portland is a place where everybody is encouraged to be their unique self, similar to some of these transformational festivals. You know, the motto, you know, keep Portland weird.
Mm-hmm.
And that means not that people are encouraged to be weird per se, but that people are encouraged to be their own unique, most creative expression of themselves. And I see that across the board. I see that in teens, in youth, in adult, in businesses, in restaurants. So I see people really coming up with their special, unique offering. And we, of course, wanted to emphasize that inclusivity at Embrace and to encourage people to share who they are in their most fullest expression of themselves. And then, of course, Portland promotes sustainability, environmental justice, environmental awareness, and we're having a speaker on eco-ministry and taking care of our planet and how we can encourage others to do so. And so we'll have, full low-waste standards and recycling and sustainability practices throughout the event, but also a emphasis on just loving our planet and creating, heaven here in this moment, in this part of our world.
So talk about some of the Portland speakers. Do we have people from Portland themselves, some alternative spiritual community leaders and whatnot? I mean,
yes, we do. Well, you'll be there.
Well, yeah, okay. I didn't mean to go there, but necessarily. But yes, but beyond that, we've got some fascinating people.
Well, we're very excited that you're going to be there with us, and you're going to be on the panel for Sacred Community and Social Transformation. So our Thursday event, we're going to have a panel of six individuals, and we'll basically be introducing the theme of the gathering then. And allowing people to do a question and answer and discussion amongst people. We have Jim Berklow coming. He's the Associate Dean of the Religious Life at the University of Southern California. And he's done a lot of work with Progressive Christians Uniting. He's going to be talking about Christian mindfulness. As I mentioned, a friend of mine, Carrie Conti, she's a psychologist, peri and postnatal psychologist. She's going to be talking about the whole courageous human and raising children. We have some amazing local people coming as well. We have a group of people coming from Revive Commons and Tabor Space, which is a local organization here, a nonprofit organization, who have a model of going into church buildings and reviving those spaces so that the churches can continue to exist in them and bringing in the neighborhood by bringing in classes and events and such. Another woman named Michelle Hawk, she's a shaman and a Reiki master. She's going to be talking about shamanism, universal shamanism. Of course, we have Matthew Fox, who I'm sure will just delight us with his passion and his creativity and his intelligence and his awareness. Rabbi Brian Mayer is a local Portlander as well. He's a rabbi, and he's going to be talking about nourishing our connection, our spiritual inner being. We have Fred Plummer from ProgressiveChristianity.org. He's going to be speaking with us. John Robinson is coming to talk about conscious aging. We have a woman coming from Australia, Alexandra Sangster, who is a pastor there as well and who has done a ton of social justice work. So she's going to be sharing stories from literally, work that she's done in the streets there, 3-day-long protests in front of the courthouse and work with refugees and such. Bruce Sangwin is coming from Canada, and he's an incredible author as well. He's done a lot of work around evolutionary Christianity, and he's moved into counseling and therapy work using psychedelics. So he's going to be talking about ayahuasca and different tools and such. And I think it's important to note that the way that our presenters are going to work is a little bit different than, for example, a conference or
a different kind of gathering. Yeah, talk about
that. How is it set up? Yeah. So we are doing a short, to use the term, quote unquote, TED Talk-like presentations. Mm-hmm. So these are going to be 25-minute long presentations, three at a time. And we do have four featured presentations, which will be a little bit longer. They'll be 45 minutes long. But most of them will be these short 25-minute presentations. And they are ideas and stories that these presenters are passionate about. So these aren't lectures. These aren't promoting their own, their recent book. These are the core nuggets of what these people who are doing incredible work in this world are currently really excited and passionate about and feel can positively affect the world. So they'll be very dynamic, fast-paced, and we will have a variety of media. Some will use screens, some will be interactive, some will have theatrical elements to it. So it'll be really fun, and we'll break in the afternoon for workshops, but mostly, most of the event is going to be a single stage, main stage event.
And where will this be?
The majority of the event will be at the incredible Portland Art Museum. Very excited that we
were
able...
That's the main stage?
That's the main stage. Friday night, we are doing a celebratory event where we are bringing in musicians, live performers, live painters. We'll have a tea lounge. We'll have a full bar. We will have a dance floor and an area for people to purchase local artisan crafts and such. And we have incredible musicians
Let's talk about some of the musicians that you have coming.
So we have two nights of music. Friday night is our celebratory event. Saturday night is our closing ceremony. Friday night is going to be in the Grand Ballroom at the Portland Art Museum. And that particular evening can be purchased separately. So that's important for people to know that if they can't make the full event, they can go to the website and purchase the ticket for that separately. And that night we'll have a band called Yaima. And we'll have a band called Indubious, both Northwest locals. And we'll also have a local favorite DJ called Dar Cernoff. These musicians are going to make us dance. They're very inspiring. Their lyrics are always moving and encouraging and positive. And
so this is going to be a moving kind of thing. It isn't just sitting and watching.
Yes.
There's audience participation, we might say.
Yeah, if wanted, there's going to be, you know, spaces for people to sit and enjoy as well so that we can provide the whole spectrum of experiencing it. And this was similar to what Matthew Fox has called his cosmic mass.
Right.
So, you know, he a long time ago came across the electronic music scene and realized that it was the younger generation's new form of worship and healing and transforming. And so that's what's happening in transformational festivals is that, you know, less and less people are needing, you know, drugs or alcohol, and more they're getting into their own spirit bodies through movement, through music, through connection with others. And a certain kind of music, electronic music, is... it kind of connects all of your chakras, especially your root chakras. So it's very grounding. It's very moving. And so that'll be our Friday night celebration. And we're going to have just incredible dancers there. And like I said, live painting and just it'll be fun. And then on Saturday night, we're going to go across the park to the UCC Sanctuary for our closing ceremony.
So this is First Congregational Church.
Exactly. First Congregational Church, UCC. And that will be seated. It's a beautiful round sanctuary. You've probably been there. And we will be bringing in ritual, meditation. We will have Ashana there who does crystal bowl singing. And she has one of the most angelic voices I've ever heard.
Hmm.
She's a very inspiring musician. And we will also have Pia, another one of our local favorites here in Portland. So Pia and her band will be there. She's just an incredible songstress and plays a variety of music or musical instruments. She's just incredibly talented. And a friend of mine, Christopher Bronzenwood, will also be playing an acoustic set there. So that night we will be a little bit more into the spiritual aspect of the musical element. And it'll be a very lovely, I think.
And is that the close?
That'll be the close
of Saturday
the event.
Night.
Yes.
Now, will people go through the whole days? Can they take parts of it? Or
so,
how does
that
work?
I mean, everybody is welcome to come and go as they please. Of course, we encourage people to try to get it all in. It's only really 2.5 days.
It begins
Thursday
afternoon through Saturday evening.
Right.
Okay.
And the Thursday is an early entry ticket, but it's going to be really fun, I think. So I encourage people to look into that as well. But then all day Friday and night and all day Saturday and Saturday night are like the two full days of the event. And we definitely encourage people to just plan on being there. We're going to have lunch breaks. We're going to have coffee and tea and some snacks available. We're going to have a village area at the Portland Art Museum, adjacent to the Sunken Ballroom, where the main stage will be during the day. And that will have local artisans and crafts and art and books and music available for purchase or to view, as well as some food offerings so that people don't have to leave if they want to purchase food on site. We'll have that available through our caterers. And then we hope that people come back after their workshop choice for our feature presentation in the afternoon. And then there'll be a nice long dinner break, and then we'll have our evening events.
This sounds fantastic. This is a lot of work.
Yeah.
You must be working 36 hours a day to organize
this. It feels like that
this.
Sometimes.
But how do you have an idea of how many people might participate in this?
Yeah. You know, we're maxed out. Our capacity is about just over 700. So, of course, we're aiming for that amount.
Okay.
We are offering scholarships. We're offering volunteer positions. We're offering group discounts. But I think that it has such a unique offering that if the word gets out, people will find it valuable to them. And it'll be very healing. You know, some people are coming because they're recovering from Christianity that they left because it was no longer relevant, or it actually hurt them because they were excluded or demonized or villainized. Some people are coming because they are interested in theology from a historical perspective. Some people are coming because they are very interested in social justice movements or eco-ministry or interfaith relations. So there's, you know, there's a wide offering here, and I think that people can find what they're looking for in their life. I think it's very possible that they can find a piece of that here that they can take home with them.
Dashna Ubeda has been my guest, talking about in the Embrace Festival, which is coming up in Portland, May 4th through 6th. And that website, again?
EmbraceFestival.com.
EmbraceFestival.com.
And you can find us on Facebook, Embrace Festival, there.
Sounds great. I hope you have a huge success. I think this is an exciting thing.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure to be here.
One of the presenters at the Embrace Festival in Portland is Greta Vosper. She's an atheist minister. She's the author of With or Without God, Why the Way We Live is More Important Than What We Believe.
It doesn't matter whether I'm an atheist or a panentheist. My point is, using that language is exclusive. And I just don't want to use the language. So the work that West Hill does could have been done by a theist or a panentheist who said, hey, wait a minute, there's this entire sector and a growing sector in our population whose spiritual needs, whose desires to be in community, to engage on the important issues of life, that whole sector is being ignored. And I have the capacity to welcome them into my space.
Greta Vosper, next on The Beloved Community. This is KBOO.
Situation, would love to see it. I remember roots bust through concrete every time. Red, gold, green, blue, Kachina stars aligned. Time keepers of the earth on the rise. When no good people living wicked in this time, I tell you this and that and this and never look you in the eye. Now see your mind's clear out of fear in this life. Let your heart remind your mouth and your mind. Never let them fool ya. We coming from an ancient tribe. Peace, keep my DNA.
In Dubious, Seventh Generation. You're listening to The Beloved Community, Resources for Activism. I'm John Schack. Greta Vosper is an atheist minister. Full disclosure, so am I. Greta is a trailblazer, though, in theological exploration and in creating communities of conscience that find God language exclusive and irrelevant. She's the author of With or Without God, Why the Way We Live is More Important Than What We Believe. Welcome, Greta, to the Beloved Community.
Wonderful to be back, John.
Good to have you back. Let's talk about all of this theist thing. Atheist and post-theist. I'm actually, I've been emboldened by you. I now call myself a Christian atheist just because it's so marvelously jarring. The whole thing is a human product. Of course it is. And this is really not anything, as if we've talked about this before, that hasn't really been talked about in higher levels of theological education.
I think that the challenges that have come to us from theological education in the liberal tradition are that we have been given the tools of critical inquiry, and we have been invited to apply those tools to the stuff of our work, and that is the Bible, that is the vast quantity of theological reflection that has gone before, and the stuff of church leadership and having integrity in the pulpit. And so we can and have evolved very intricate descriptions of what we mean when we're talking about God, or how we seek to approach the Bible. And we have mostly used those to explain and excuse the ways that we use language in the context of our community's faith. And I think that perhaps one of the most embraced things of God in the United Church of Canada, certainly as was identified by a survey that I have a lot of problems with, but still, it identified that about well over half of the clergy in the United Church of Canada have a panentheistic understanding of God. And I really don't care what the definition of panentheistic God is, except insofar as where does that leave me in terms of the doctrinal statements that the United Church is now trying to drill into us. So a panentheistic understanding is usually an understanding of God that pervades the universe, that is beyond the universe, that can interpenetrate the universe, may or may not have a supernatural interventionist element. But it's not anything that someone who has not done significant reading on it would really understand as what we think God is in the general public. So you have a majority of clergy who understand God in a panentheistic way. And that, for me, I have a hard time legitimizing those kinds of names if we aren't also going to legitimize names like atheist when it comes to an understanding of God. Because a theistic God is a God with being, with character, with attributes, with which we can interrelate generally. It's generally accepted that that's what it is. I don't think we can really do that with a panentheistic God. And I don't think we do that with an atheistic God. Like, if we have complex understandings of what God is, but we continue to use the word God to describe them, then it doesn't matter how intricate or how evolved or how broad-minded those understandings of God are. If somebody thinks when I'm using that word that I mean God in heaven, or God who's going to answer my prayers, or God who's going to, you know, provide me the right opportunities for my life when those opportunities are needed, I'm not getting across to people. So it doesn't matter whether I'm an atheist or a panentheist. My point is, using that language is exclusive, and I just don't want to use the language. So the work that West Hill does could have been done by a theist or a panentheist who said, hey, wait a minute, there's this entire sector and a growing sector in our population whose spiritual needs, whose desires to be in community, to engage on the important issues of life, that whole sector is being ignored. And I have the capacity to welcome them into my space if I just can find a way to make it more inclusive.
Absolutely. So, talk a little bit about West Hill, if you don't mind, and the kind of folks who attend there and what they do get out of this community.
Thank you, John, for that opportunity, because this is really a story about a congregation that has courageously moved into a place beyond the language that defined it for. And they have done so in order to remove barriers. And there are people in that community who are believers, and there are people who are not believers. But in the conversation about who we wanted to be as a community, what came to the fore was those values that we wanted to engage in. And it was kind of like Sam Harris in his book, The End of Faith. He does this thought experiment where we wake up one morning and we don't remember anything. We don't remember language. We don't remember what foods we can eat. We don't remember anything at all. And he says, you know, at what point do we have to remember the story of the virgin birth, right? Like, that would be way down the list. And so that's kind of what happened at West Hill. We decided, what are the things that, if we were starting this all over again, are the most important things to take forward? And they pulled out of their tradition the elements of the story that had most meaning and purpose to them. And those were the elements about love, the struggle toward living with compassion, and all the contextual challenges that places upon us, the working toward justice, throwing ourselves against those impenetrable walls again and again in efforts to allow rights to be offered to people who have been denied them before. Voices can be raised for those who have been silenced or who believe that they're not worthy of being heard. Those kinds of pieces that come to us, and many will say that they come out of the gospel tradition. Some will say they come out of the ancient Hebraic tradition. Some will recognize that they come from a number of religious traditions. And many will say those are humanistic values. So that's what we uplift there. And what you see when you come to West Hill is really, you know, you see a traditional church, like half the church is pews and half the church is chairs. And you do this stand up and sing hymns, and all of the words of which are focused on values and don't include exclusive terms about deities or privilege a particular person as the most representative of love that ever was. Readings are the same readings. Anything that is worthy of being brought into the space is read as a reading, so that doesn't focus us exclusively on biblical readings. We read them very rarely, actually. You see, we have secular music that is brought in and shared with a choir, sometimes with a soloist. We have a lot of music that has been written specifically for our congregation by my husband, Scott Kearns, who is an extremely gifted musician and composer. And the service lasts about an hour and a half, and then we have a fellowship time after it. The first Sunday of every month, we have a potluck meal. So it's like any other church. We had a bazaar a couple of weeks ago to raise money, a Christmas bazaar. And, you know, it looks, smells, feels, and wags its tail like a church. We just don't have language as an exclusive thing. And what I think that has done in terms of creating an extraordinary community is that West Hill spends an hour and a half each week talking about what is important, how we want to live, how we've failed that, how our lives are, you know, subject and vulnerable to all the vagaries of life, and we share them with each other as they hit us. And we are able then to step into every moment with a wide heart, prepared to do what needs to be done that comes before us as a challenge, prepared to respond to the community beyond us, prepared to take action on a national scale in terms of some of the challenges that, you know, that our values place before us. The approval of the Kinder Morgan pipeline has completely winded a lot of us. So we're talking about ways to do that. That our pension board refused for the third time in 10 years to divest of gold core stocks, which is another issue that I'm raising with my board. Like, we know what's right and we know what's wrong and we know what we're going to deal with. We aren't fooling ourselves by just putting everything in biblical terms and using a language that isn't relevant to what's going on outside our door. Whatever we are talking about in that church is exactly what's relevant outside the door as well, and vice versa. So we are deeply embedded in what's going on in our community and in the lives of the people that we serve. And it gives us a lightness on our feet when it comes to discerning what it is we have to do.
I appreciate what you're doing. You are a trailblazer and are opening the conversation up for many people, whether they're within the church or without it. And it's much appreciated. So all the best to you.
Thank you very much, John.
This is The Beloved Community, every second Friday at 9 a.m. on KBOO. I'm John Shuck. Up next, I speak with Brett Webb Mitchell, author of Practicing Pilgrimage, on being and becoming God's pilgrim people.
This is what we do. We walk for matters of justice, housing, equity. We're against misogyny. We're against anything that has to do with discrediting anyone of race or religion. I mean, again, this is the way of Jesus. Anyone, regardless of gender or sexual orientation, identification, we walk for justice. That's what we do.
This is The Beloved Community on KBOO. Stay with us.
And if the darkness is to keep us apart, and if the daylight feels like it's a long way off, and if your glass heart should crack, and for a second you turn back, oh no, be strong, oh, oh, walk on, walk.
You too. Walk on. This is The Beloved Community on KBOO. Dr. Brett Webb Mitchell is a pilgrim, speaker, writer, teacher, ordained Presbyterian minister, parent, partner, and pet lover. In 1999, he came out as a gay man, and it was a pilgrimage that enabled him to be honest with himself. Currently, Brett is pastor serving St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church in Portland, Oregon, having been on the faculty of Duke University and North Carolina Central University in Durham, North Carolina. He is the author of 10 books and 3 on pilgrimage. His latest is Practicing Pilgrimage, on being and becoming God's pilgrim people. Brett directs the School of the Pilgrim, taking people on pilgrimage around the world and in their backyards. We discuss pilgrimage as spiritual awakening, liberation, and protest. Welcome, Brett, to The Beloved Community.
Good morning.
Well, talk about pilgrimage. How did you get involved in deciding to become a pilgrim?
Right. In the first few books I wrote on people with disabilities, one of the first few essays, I pulled on the image of people with disabilities, especially children with disabilities that I was working with, primarily children with autistic-like behaviors that fell across that spectrum as being located or isolated in the public or town square and of a medieval village. And they were kind of pilgrims without a church, pilgrims without an inn, pilgrims without a family, pilgrims without any kind of services providing them any kind of anchor. And so I used that metaphor. It seemed to work. I had read Canterbury Tales. I had seen and read many travel essays. Came from a family that loved to travel. And that image seemed to work in my understanding of working with people with disabilities and trying to explain why they were not welcomed into the life of faith communities, per se. And I had two Catholic friends. One who was the former secretary to Thomas Keating, who wrote about centering prayer, and another, and his name was Paul, and Megan McKenna, who was a New Testament theologian. And they said, you know, you really write pretty things about pilgrimage. Too bad you've never been on one. And they got me. And so they arranged that I go on my first pilgrimage in 1999, which was to Chimayo, northern New Mexico. It's a very holy site in which much healing comes. It's kind of the Lords of the Americas, if you will. I was transformed. It was one of those experiences that kind of upset my apple cart. It changed how I understood discipleship, education, and the life of the church. It broadened my understanding of faith. It broadened my understanding of not only of the Catholic traditions, but also of native spirituality, because a lot of the people who were on the pilgrimage with me were from Taos Pueblo. So it was both this kind of strain of Native American spirituality, as well as deep and kind of mysterious northern New Mexico spirituality that had this influence upon me in walking 120 miles in 6 days, which, you know, you're averaging around 18, 19, 20 miles a day. It's so out of my realm as a Presbyterian, as a Protestant, in terms of understanding education and church and all, that I was hooked. It was different than a hike. It was different than a vacation. It was different than a journey anywhere, than a historical journey that I had grown up with. And so that was the first one that kind of set my life towards understanding myself, not only literally, but also metaphorically as a pilgrim. And so.
Mm-hmm. So what is it about the pilgrimage or the journeying that connects us to what is holy? Is it kind of an awakening to the impermanence of life?
Yeah. I think, again, for the Muslim, Jew, and Christian, for us, our roots go back to Abraham and Sarah. And I think what's interesting is, in all the literature, they are always pointed to, this couple are pointed to as the first pilgrims, as the first ones that God calls them to a new land. And so they follow God. They are the ones who are the chief doubters. I doubt that she's ever going to have a baby. I doubt that we're ever going to get anywhere. I doubt that there's anything that good's going to come out of this relationship. They are the chief doubters, in which God keeps on showing them time and time again, now follow me and this will happen. Follow me, do this and this will happen. And so they become, for us, the paradigm, the prototype of a pilgrim life, because following that, you have Moses following that. And for me, I think where it helped me in my faith was understanding Jesus as one of the late brothers from the Taizé community called Jesus the Pilgrim God. For me, especially as a gay man, what kept me in the faith when there was everything within our denomination in the Presbyterian Church, let alone other denominations, especially United Methodists and the like, who are still not at the party yet. What kept me in was not the politics of our church. It was the relationship with Brother Jesus or the Pilgrim God. I could relate and felt in my coming out, and this was crucial. 1999 wasn't only my first pilgrimage, but it was also the year that I was coming out of the closet. Mm. And so it became the power for me of the walking experience of putting on my shoes and lacing them up and walking also helped me become a metaphor by which I could understand the coming out process. For those of us who are gay or lesbian, bisexual, trans, queer, questioning, or intersex in the LGBTQI community, there is the useful metaphor of a closet. But there's for me, the next step was not only the closet, got that, I felt that, but I needed a metaphor, I needed a way to talk about coming out. And for me, that was a pilgrimage, that Brother Jesus gave me the tools, gave me the way, showed me the way of living honestly. And I even said this to the church this last week in a sermon. The sermon's title was Authenticity. Because Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew is talking about, you have heard that it was said, but I say to you. And one of the first ones is, you know, not only not murder, but don't say anything false about your sister or brother. Well, as a gay man, I had a lot of people talking about me. So I think that it was always helpful for me to understand that my coming out process was a pilgrimage in which Brother Jesus was walking with me. Even though the church wasn't necessarily in terms of the institution, I had enough brothers and sisters who were walking with me that I could understand that. So for me personally, it's always been a most helpful practice, but also metaphor that I could that I could explain what was going on within my life, but also I have found other LGBTQI people who understand that it's a helpful metaphor for them as well.
As you mentioned, because we're talking also about pilgrimages, social justice. You have a chapter on a pilgrimage of justice and peace. You mentioned the civil rights movement. It seems like every week in Portland, we have a march for justice in some sense of another, Black Lives Matter or the Women's March, or a march for housing justice, I know is coming up. So what makes a political march a pilgrimage? And is there a time when a march might not be a pilgrimage?
Mm-hmm. I think, again, it goes back to the understanding of the mind of the and the awareness and social consciousness of the one who's on the journey. So in looking at, for example, Selma to Montgomery and all, that was a spiritual march. The way that King and Abernathy and the like understood themselves, I mean, Rosa Parks and all these wonderful figures of American history now, they understood that that their march of justice was a justice that was declared by God. And so they bracketed in such language. For me, most recently, as you know, coming from North Carolina, I was a early participant in what has since become known as the Moral Monday marches. Reverend Barber was at Duke when I was teaching at Duke. So I knew him as a student at Duke. Reverend Barber has bracketed everything that he's done with the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina and beyond in the language of social justice, but of God's justice. Therefore, if you were to ask him, if you were to ask Reverend Barber, are you a Democrat, are you a Republican, or are you independent? He would have said, this is not about politics. He said, I would have been strongly cursing the Democrats if they were practicing injustice as I would a Republican. So I think that even with St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church, what I've tried to help us do is consider in what ways, given the political day and age in which we live, what we do as a community of faith is based upon gospel justice, so that it is free of politics in terms of the body politics or the state politics, but is founded solely upon the politics of the kingdom of God. To use that language, I think the late John Howard Yoder talked about that kind of thing. Martin Luther King Jr. talks about that. Reverend Barber does. So that these marches, what we're doing is we're participating in an act of God's justice that goes beyond the politics of this day and age. The way we're reacting today, I believe Jesus would have reacted to Caesar and Tiberius. And so there's really, I mean, this is nothing new to us as people of faith. This is what we do. We walk for matters of justice, housing, equity. We're against misogyny. We're against anything that has to do with discrediting anyone of race or religion. I mean, again, this is the way of Jesus. Anyone, regardless of gender or sexual orientation, identification, we walk for justice. That's what we do.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Brett Webb Mitchell, my guest, Practicing Pilgrimage is his book on being and becoming God's pilgrim people. You have a website called School of the Pilgrim.
I do.
How do people enroll?
Well, what they do is go on there, and what it offers is ways of, for example, if you will, hiring me out. Because what I want to start doing is offering, for example, say at Southminster or St. Andrews. I did this last weekend, in fact, with First Presbyterian Church Corvallis, taking people on retreats, taking them on a 2 or 3 day retreat, and helping people learn about the pilgrimage. And so what I think I'm becoming, John, is I'm becoming an evangelist for pilgrimage. And so I want people to understand, and there is, because of the plethora of labyrinths that are around the area, interdenominationally as well as interreligious, I kind of want to beckon people to take the next step, if you will, both metaphorically as well as literally, and go on a pilgrimage. Because I think that, again, the labyrinths were created for those who could not go to Jerusalem, for example, or to Rome or Santiago de Compostela. So what I'm wanting to do with School of the Pilgrim is offer my services to help people go on a journey. So by creating opportunities in the Portland area or taking a group of people to Santiago, I'm taking a group of United Methodist ministers in May. I've invited a group of friends, for example, to go with me to Machu Picchu in October. So constantly inviting people to go along with me, as well as myself going on intentional pilgrimages by myself once a year so that I can keep on every year remembering who and whose I am.
Practicing Pilgrimage on Being and Becoming God's Pilgrim People. Brett Webb Mitchell has been my guest. That's his book. And your website for your School of the Pilgrim?
www.schoolofthepilgrim.com.
Brett, thanks so much for being with me.
I appreciate it, John.
You've been listening to The Beloved Community, Resources for Activism. Catch The Beloved Community every second Friday at 9 a.m. on KBOO. Find more information about The Beloved Community and my weekly show, Progressive Spirit, at progressivespirit.net. That's progressivespirit.net. From the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, I'm John Schott. Be well.
Hey, this is Khalid Mosley. Tune in on KBOO Community Radio for Rose City Rip Hop. This Friday, March 10th, I will be speaking to local group DPD, also known as Death on Dummies, and other special guests. As we discuss the importance of hip-hop and get a little personal understanding of them as a collective and what all that they stand for. Listen in on 90.7.fm or at kboo.fm. Search for Rose City Rip Hop for more information and upcoming showtimes. Thank you. Have a good day.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Gospel of Loving Kindness at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland. The Gospel of Loving Kindness is a play by Marcus Gardley based on the true story of 15-year-old Hadiya Pendleton, who was killed in Chicago after performing at the presidential inauguration in 2013. This play runs from March 10th through April 9th on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. Again, that's The Gospel of Loving Kindness, March 10th through April 9th on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, 5340 North Interstate in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, March 10th, 2017. You're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio, your sanctuary radio, your resistance radio at 90.7 FM on the air, kboo.fm everywhere. Do not forget to call Earl Blumenauer and make your feelings known regarding this Trumper campaign.